Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne. Remember when Fargo first came out?
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Frances McDormand played a pregnant police officer in northern Minnesota. It was winter, Minnesota looked a lot like Siberia, and she was investigating a series of murders involving a desperate car salesman's attempt to kidnap his wife. Well, the Coen brothers cleaned up on Oscar nominations for that film, and then, in 2014, FX decided it would be a good idea to create Fargo, the TV series. Which you would think would be a terrible idea, right? I mean, TV adaptations tend to flop. But two seasons in, Fargo is a huge hit. It's had 133 award nominations. It's won 32. And the show's third season premieres this week on April 19th. Doug Gordon caught up with the guy behind Fargo's success, creator and showrunner Noah Hawley.
Noah, how did you become the guy who adapted the Coen brothers' 1996 film Fargo into a TV series?
I said to them, I think that what you could do is every year you could tell a whole new story that fits into the mindset of what Fargo means. You know, it's both evocative of a place, what Joel and Ethan called Siberia with family restaurants, you know, which is sort of open tundra. But also now after that movie, it's evocative of a kind of story, you know, a true crime story where truth is stranger than fiction. So, You know, I just found myself in that moment presented with this challenge to be somewhat uniquely qualified to take it on. What FX said to me was, we'd love to make a series out of Fargo, but we're wondering, can you do it without Marge? Because Frances McDormand's performance was so iconic, you can't really recast and do the further adventures of Marge.
And I guess that was your accomplice in the wood chipper. And those three people in Brainerd. And for what? For a little bit of money. There's more to life than a little money, you know. Don't you know that? And here you are. And it's a beautiful day.
But that was very interesting because then they were basically asking me, can you adapt this movie without any of the characters from the movie or the story from the movie? So then what are you really doing except trying to capture a tone of voice?
As you mentioned, one of the things you decided to do to transform the movie Fargo into the TV series Fargo was that it's got to be an anthology. Each season is its own unique thing, different characters, different storylines. Can you kind of give me some insight into your creative process about what else you decided to do to make it work as a TV series?
Well, for me, you know, starting as a novelist, like it has to have a thematic content to it and a sort of underpinning of what the story is about that is greater than just the sum of its parts. So this idea of, you know, which I found was imbued in the movie of civilization versus the wilderness. If it's a place where you can get the meatballs at the buffet and then freeze to death in the parking lot, like there is this sense that you're on the border of true wilderness in a sort of elemental way. And that idea that when someone like Jerry Lundegaard goes to see Buscemi and Peter Stormare, that he's going into the wilderness, in the criminal wilderness, and what happens when a civilized man goes into the wilderness. And I felt the same instinct with Martin Freeman's character and when he collides with Billy Bob in that emergency room, that sense that he had put on his mucklucks and gone out into the wilderness and brought something back with him that then sort of poisoned the rest of the story.
He had his sons with him, and
you let a man beat you in front of his children to send them a message?
No, that's not. Just, heck.
In my experience, if you let a man break your nose, the next time he tries to break your spine.
Sam, no way. I mean, I don't think. It just, I guess I embarrassed him in front of his boys.
You embarrassed him?
Yeah, by, He was telling me about a time where he and my wife, they were, but he didn't know she was my wife is the thing. And when I told him,
this man slept with your wife and you're worried about embarrassing him.
Not slept. No, they didn't. He said it was just, She has soft hands, see, and I guess
Mister, we're not friends. I mean, maybe we will be someday. But I gotta say, if that were me in your position, I would have killed that man.
And this idea of tone, it made me think of the Warren Littlefield quote about that saying that you would try and capture the Coen DNA, Fargo as a state of mind, to capture that sensibility of people in the dead of winter. And they've got, as you were talking about earlier, they have to bundle up and dress warmly to brace themselves from
right.
elements and things and then prepare themselves for what life throws at them. And so you're trying to reveal their stories and watch them cope with all these different forms of trials and tragedy.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, it's this balance of really just basically decent people who are confronted by these evils and this idea. There's a sort of simplicity to, you know, as presented in the movie, the sort of regional sense of decorum and restraint and humility.
Minnesota nice.
Yeah, and this idea that you would never embarrass someone by asking them how they're feeling and you would never burden them by telling them how you're feeling. And as a result, you have a lot of characters who can't communicate with each other. And that's what I found so impressive about the film, Fargo, was I don't think that Bill Macy's character ever finished a sentence, you know, because every time he started to make a declarative sentence, it risks offending someone. So he would kind of come at it from another angle.
No. See, I don't need a finder's fee. I need finder's fees. What, 10%? Heck, that's not going to do it for me. I need the principle.
And that's really exciting for me as a writer is how do I tell you what the character means without the character saying what they mean? How do you communicate that sense of what's going on beneath the surface where, you know, most of television is people saying their subtext out loud?
Yeah. Much as I like the film, I like the TV series a lot more. And I'd appreciate it if you didn't mention that to Joel and Ethan, because I'm in an awful water with them. Thank you.
Luckily, this won't be on the radio.
No. Yeah, of course not. I think one of the reasons that your adaptation of Fargo is so successful has to do with your idea of this 10-hour movie, that Fargo, each season is like a 10-hour movie. And so you have all this extra time to spend with these characters and get to know them. It's so much more immersive.
Well, and tonally, I mean, if you look back at the movie Fargo, when I rewatched it, I realized it's a lot more comic than we remember, actually, and that the way the movie ended and the violence of it and the dignity of Marge's character, the movie in our memories lives in a much more dramatic space, I think. And so I knew if I did exactly the tone of the movie, people would think that I got it wrong. But I also knew that making it into a 10-hour film required it to have a dramatic infrastructure that was a little more grounded and the stakes were a little higher and the story had to be bigger because you had to have enough moving pieces on a collision course that you could never really predict with certainty which ones were going to collide and when, which added to that truthiness of this fake true story. And it does allow us more canvas to explore themes, to play with digressions, to tell parts of the story that couldn't fit into a two-hour movie. And so the exploration of it, the trying to define this, what I see really as a new medium, this 8 or 10 hour movie, you know, that's been the most exciting part.
Yeah, this is a tough question, I know, but do you have any favorite scenes or characters from the first two seasons?
One that stands out from this last season is a scene I directed, actually, which was in the second hour when Ted Danson pulls over Mike Milligan's car and has a sort of very tense scene by the side of the road and a very isolated stretch of road with a policeman pulling over three crooks. The power does not rest with Ted Danson in that scene, but he does an amazing job of sort of showing his steel to these guys and showing us his nerves at the same time.
Okay. I got your names and your plate number. I'm gonna radio ahead and make sure you make it out of state. Not, I'm going to put out a APB and have you boys rounded up, and then we'll talk again. You understand?
I do. And isn't that a minor miracle? The state of the world today, the level of conflict and misunderstanding, that two men could stand on a lonely road in winter and talk calmly and rationally, while all around them people were losing their mind. You have a nice day.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
Basically anything with Kirsten Dunst in it is going to be gold.
All the acting was great, but I was really surprised by just how great she was.
Yeah, you know, that character is so unhinged on some level, and yet you can't know that right away. She has to be a grounded person with a real point of view, and you know, I think that last scene between her and Patrick Wilson in the car has to be another one of my favorites where, you know, after 10 hours of being the strong silent type, Patrick Wilson finally opens up about his war experience, how hard it is for him in this moment, and Peggy does the same, and we realize how trapped she feels by being a woman in this region at this moment.
I just wanted to be someone.
Well, you're somebody now.
No, see? I wanted to choose. Be my own me. Not be defined by someone else's expectations. And then that guy, that stupid guy, walked out into the... Why'd he have to do that?
You mean the victim?
No, that's not fair. Because I'm a victim, too. Was a victim first. Before him.
And yet at the end of it, he says, people are dead, Peggy. It doesn't justify anything, so.
Yeah. One of the season two episodes, I want to ask you about this one episode that started in a very strange way. We see this hardcover book called The History of True Crime in the Midwest pulled from a bookshelf. The pages flip open to show that the entire second season has just been one chapter of this more expansive history book, this blunderbuss featuring full-color drawings of all of the murder victims from this season. And then we hear this voiceover from the actor Martin Freeman, who, of course, played Lester Nygaard in season one. Is this how you think of Fargo, as this vast narrative that explores the history of quote-unquote true crime in the Midwest?
I guess it was a conceit that came into my head toward the end of the first year in thinking about the anthological nature of the series and the film sort of fitting in on some way. We found the money that he buried in our first year, and this sense that maybe, you know, the stories of the more famous stories of this region have been collected in a book on some level, and there are those books out there, and that maybe that universe, for lack of a better word, comes from someplace. It's an idea, you know, of a book within a movie. You know, obviously Wes Anderson does a lot with that, but there are a lot of other filmmakers as well, where there's a story within a story within a story, which is always really interesting to me.
Yeah, Matryoshka dolls, nesting Matryoshka dolls, story and story and story.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really admired about Fargo is the sound design and the way you use music. And one of my favorite examples of the way you used music is the seventh episode, I think, from season two. The opening montage is scored with Locomotive Breath, a song by Jethro Tull. What made you decide to use that song?
Well, you know, we went around with which songs. I mean, it was a very long montage sequence, a sort of almost Scorsese gang war sequence of the Gerhardt family and their attacks on Kansas City and the reprisals and the toll that it was taking. And so it really needed an iconic piece of music. And you watch it a lot of times with a lot of different songs on there. What I loved about that song in particular was it starts very softly with this piano introduction that takes you into, you know, sort of swelling guitars that then go into a rock song, and it just seemed to hit all the right beats and the right moments. There's something about Jethro Tull that is so 70s, so period, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. The synchronicity was amazing. It's like Wizard of Oz and Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, just how well the images and the song go together, because we see all these images of death, the window washer shooting into an office and killing three people.
They need to know.
Ah!
there's a funeral, a man being drowned in a toilet from the toilet bowl's point of view, the toilet bowl cam, which then dissolves into the shot of the cup of coffee with cream swirling in it. And as you say, we're seeing all this murder and mayhem, and we're hearing a song that uses an impending train wreck as an allegory for a man's life falling apart. It really is incredibly well done.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the upcoming season of Fargo, season 3?
You know, we've signed on Ewan McGregor to play two roles, actually. He plays these brothers, one of whom is a sort of older, successful parking lot king of Minnesota, and his younger, you know, sort of less good-looking brother who's a parole officer and someone who believes in punching down. He's a little bit of a bully toward his parolees because he feels like he was bullied by his brother. And you know, there's a kind of original sin between these two brothers that comes back to haunt them. And each of these seasons kind of starts with a catalyst, whether it's two men meeting in an emergency room or a woman driving home with a man sticking out of her windshield and making dinner for her husband. So what I love about the movie Fargo is that it's not a whodunit. There's no mystery. You meet the criminals before the crime is committed, and then you don't meet law enforcement until their naturally occurring place in the story, which is after the crime has been committed. And therefore, it's a story of all the pieces without needing any sort of whodunit nature to it. And so that catalyst, what is that catalyst that brings all these players into orbit around each other and on a collision course? That's always sort of the critical component. And then designing enough moving pieces that it does have that element of randomness to it and unpredictability, which I think is hopefully one of our hallmarks, is a story that's unpredictable when you watch it, but that feels inevitable when it's done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the most compelling things about it. Yeah. So are we going to see any more of the aliens that made those brief cameo appearances in the second season?
You know, you never know. You got to look up from time to time. But, you know, I don't think that's going to be a strong runner in the history of Fargo.
No, I suspect not. But we'll look forward to season 3. Thanks so much, Noah.
Thank you.
That's Noah Hawley, the creator and showrunner of the TV series Fargo, and he was talking with Doug Gordon. The third season of Fargo premieres on Wednesday, April 19th. I'm Anne Strainchamps. For more episodes of To the Best of Our Knowledge, check out our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you look for your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by these folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.